Welcome to the 118th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 19 years to the day that England clinched victory in Karachi to secure their first series victory in Pakistan for 39 years. Welcome to another team of Englishmen whose enthusiasm is undimmed by years of failure.
And we are going to be continuing our... continuing our home run of failure, but that sounds a bit negative to start off a podcast, doesn't it? But we have got some fun to talk about. We are going to be talking about, actually, the England cricket team in the 1980s, courtesy of Derek Pringle's autobiography, Pushing the Boundaries. Andy's going to also be taking us back to the IPL in 2008, the first ever IPL. And we're going to be looking at some of the things that have been happening lately, including the recent announcement of the 2020 county calendar. You're in the depths of winter at the moment, Andy, and you're kind of looking forward with hope to next spring.
Yes, so the county fixtures for next year came out in late November, and you read through this list on a dark, wet winter afternoon, and it's just a wonderful piece of escapism. You can't help but start plotting your plans and dreams for next season. You also start convincing yourself that April isn't all that far away.
April is always sunny. That's the other thing that always strikes me about this. You sit here thinking, oh, April, it'll be beautiful in April. And you get to April and it's kind of frostbite territory still.
Yeah, no, that particular experience, particularly from a playing point of view,
yes,
of going out for that first game of the season
jumpers,
wearing thermals. Yeah. I think I've banged on before on the podcast. I'm desperate to get some new grounds away from particularly some of the familiar London haunts. And on the fixture list, my eyes were particularly drawn to some of the outgrounds. I think there's a particular romance to these always. I mean, how can you not be up for the Battle of the Roses at Scarborough in June, or perhaps Glamorgan at Colwyn Bay in late August? I mean, the romance of those places, pretty irresistible. And it just makes you want to get the sandwiches, sausage rolls and sun hat and ready to go.
What was that book? Is it a book by, I can't remember who it's by, a book about someone who goes around, tries to get around all of the county grounds? And I always think that that's the way to do it, to have a particular project that you can justifiably set aside a whole summer and say, right, that's just it. I'm taking leave without pay from work and I'm just going to get around the country and do nothing but crisscross the country via county grounds.
Well, we had listener Julian Bishop on the show a few episodes back who did something very similar, and he made the wonderful point that as well as it being a great way to watch a lot of cricket, it's also quite a fun way to see the country. You know, it takes
yes.
you to some places that you've never been to before. So, yes, high hopes for 2020. But aside from visiting interesting grounds, you have been more focused on the pitch at the centre of one very significant ground.
Yes, so I've always had this thing about groundskeepers. I actually quite pity them because everyone from commentators through to, you know, amateur club cricketers has a view on what makes a good or bad pitch. Everyone can wander up to a pitch and say, oh, it's got too much grass on it, or it's too dry, or it hasn't been treated properly. But actually, none of those people actually has a clue about what goes into making a good wicket happen. And for groundskeepers, they're stuck between trying to fulfil the wishes of the home captain that has built a certain kind of side and therefore wants a certain kind of pitch versus, you know, the club or country bean counters who want a pitch that will go all 5 days and produce entertaining cricket. But at the same time, these poor people are also competing against the elements, you know, the simple fact that it is the weather that defines what, you know, how a pitch turns out. So it was, I suppose, with a bit of a combination of amusement and sympathy that I read about the match that was abandoned at the weekend between Victoria and WA at the MCG. And particularly in the context of the MCG pitch has been accused for quite a long time of being far too docile, of being far too batsman friendly. It's been a bit of a road where people have just been able to score runs to their heart's content. During this particular game, the one that was happening at the end of last week, both Marcus Stoinis and Sean Marsh were hit by balls that reared off a length. Both of them ended up having to go to hospital. And amusingly, there was quite a kind of po-faced statement put out by the club that the groundskeepers had, quote, gone a bit too far in putting more movement in the wicket. This was in the context of batsmen nearly having their heads taken off. And what had happened was that they had wanted to try and spice up this pitch a bit because they realised realised that the MCG pitch was a bit flat. But that had coincided, the work that they'd done had coincided with a couple of days of rain, which had really softened the ground. Then it had been played on, so some divots had been created in that softened ground. Then it had been, there'd been intense heat, and that had baked those divots into the pitch. And so whenever the ball was hitting those, it was hitting these really hard little divots in the pitch, and the ball was rearing all over the place. And so the poor grounds people are sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't. Without that weather, the pitch would probably have been really good, but suddenly they've done what they need to. The weather has undermined them.
I think it also fits into this odd notion that even the greatest groundsman can somehow produce a perfect pitch to order. I mean, even if the weather plays ball, like a lot of groundsmen will say, you know, it's difficult to predict. It's a sort of, you know, art/science. It's not, you can't guarantee certain conditions. And I guess, of course, part of the pleasure of the game remains, you know, the safety aspect is always important, but that degree of unpredictability as well, you know, not being quite sure what the weather will throw at you.
Exactly. And so the next sort of big moment for that MCG pitch is the Australia-New Zealand Boxing Day test, obviously on the 26th of December, clues in the title as to what date that is. So it'll be fascinating. Immediately after this game, apparently the Australian Cricket Australia wrote to the New Zealand team and said, don't worry, we will have a pitch that's playable ready for you by the end of December. So it'll be fascinating to see how it actually ends up playing out.
I think when teams start apologising for this, it sets you in a really interesting position, because, you know, you think of some of the controversies we've had in County Championship in recent years and historically as well around teams being fined for pitches. And I think one thing those controversies have always shown is the delicate boundary line between what is considered a interesting competitive pitch and an illegal pitch. You know, it does happen, but it's actually relatively rare that there's been sort of examples of kind of total consensus on this is a bad pitch.
From the archives. Now, next week, the IPL 2020 auction takes place. And so Andy's going to be looking back at the first ever IPL auction in 2008 through the stories of the two most expensive overseas players.
So when the IPL launched, it had this concept of icon players. So these were Indian legends who would be assigned to play for their hometown team ahead of the auction. So the idea was you give these teams an identity by keeping those players and you create fan interest. So very quickly, these players were Tendulkar for the Mumbai Indians, Ganguly for the Kolkata Knight Riders, Dravid for Royal Challengers Bangalore, and Yuvraj Singh for the Kings 11 Punjab. Now, the icon players received 15% more money than the highest paid player of the team bought in the auction. You can quickly see that is a pretty lucrative deal.
Mm.
It did, however, mean that the teams with icons quickly found themselves hamstrung in the auction. So, for example, it seems as if the Mumbai Indians lost out in the bidding war for Mahendra Singh Dhoni because of the amount of money they needed to give to Tendulkar.
And was that a question in terms of their budget, or a question that you know, Dhoni, for instance, would have known that Tendulkar was getting 1.5 his fee and therefore would, I mean, I suppose Dhoni didn't have a say as to whether he was, you know, auctioned off to a particular team, so it was literally a question of how deep are our pockets, we just can't afford this.
Well, it's a fascinating question, because I hadn't actually thought of that, the kind of psychology for Dhoni of being like, oh, I know however much I get, Tendulkar will get 15% more.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to try 50% less hard than Tendulkar.
But the reason the teams were really hamstrung was there was this $5 million salary cap. So the fact that if you spent an awful lot on that one icon player, it then sort of limited how crazy, frankly, you could go in the rest of the auction.
Right, so $5 million across the whole team.
Exactly. Now, crucially, a player who Deccan Chargers wanted to be an icon but wasn't was VVS Laxman. And Laxman did this rather selfless thing, and this will have consequences when we get onto our two overseas players. in that he said, don't nominate me because it's going to cause you problems with the salary cap. He actually had a foresight of this issue.
Interesting.
And in the end, he went to Deccan for just $375,000, which if you look at the amount Tendulkar and others, these icon players went for, around, you know, a million and more, it suggests he probably only got a third of what he might have done had he gone as an icon player. Now, freed up by Laxman's generosity, Deccan landed the most expensive overseas player in the auction, Australian all-rounder Andrew Simons. Now, he was seen by many, including himself, as rather a surprise choice for this unusual and expensive honour. There was an added kind of element of drama to this in the only months before there had been the Monkey Gate saga in the Test series
with Harbhajan Singh.
You know, we won't dig too much into that now, but it's quite interesting in the context that only a couple of months after that, after all the bad blood, an Indian team was putting forward a huge amount of money to bring him to their side.
And do you think that actually Simons was kind of, because when I think back to Andrew Simons, he's kind of one of those cricketers who I will confess, until you said his name then, I haven't thought about him for a while, because he was, you know, it was a cricketer who, yes, changed games on his day, but not a cricketer who was reliably going to, as an all-rounder, you know, game in, game out, was going to reliably sort of control a game for you through the wickets that he took and through the runs that he scored as well, which, I don't know, maybe I'm just kind of misremembering how influential he was as a cricketer and how much he did change games, but that doesn't seem to be my memory of him, actually.
So I think we're now getting to the point where there's a huge amount of analysis into 2020, what makes a good player, what makes a valuable player. I think at this stage, there's a lot to suggest that the 2008 auction involved a lot of guessing.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just didn't have a huge amount of stats and history to work from. I guess Simons fitted a certain model in that he was a hard-hitting all-rounder. I think being an all-rounder was crucial. You know, you were bringing in someone who could do a bit of everything. He made an average start with the bat, but in his third game struck an unbeaten 117 off 53 balls. He was, however, to go on to lose the game for Deccan with the ball. He delivered the final over the game. Rajasthan needed 17 off the final over, and they got it with a ball to spare. Shane Warne, of all people, hitting his compatriot for three consecutive boundaries. Simons described it as the worst over in T20 history, a slightly amusing reference given the limit of T20 history.
Yes, exactly. At this stage. This has been going for 10 minutes and I've just done the worst.
And after just four games, his IPL was over because he had to join up with the Australian team's tour of the West Indies. And as a result, he only received a very small percentage of his auction price. And I think it's intriguing to think, in the context of what's happened since, what he must have made of that individually. You know, going out for a tour of the West Indies, knowing the amount of money he was effectively leaving on the table back in India. It's also, I think, a great reminder, you know, now the IPL has its win in the future tours program, it's basically respected by the international sides, but it's a reminder that in these early days the IPL was this insurgent tournament and the power very much remained with the Test sides.
So now, who was the other most expensive player alongside Simons?
Well, the other most expensive player was in some ways a similar type of player, another explosive, hard-hitting all-rounder, the Sri Lankan Sanath Jayasuriya, signed by the Mumbai Indians for just under $1 million. Now, at 38 years of age, Jayasuriya must have feared that he was in danger of missing out on the IPL's riches. And, you know, it's interesting, if you see former players being interviewed, this is a pretty common grumble. You can imagine how galling it is, particularly if you were sort of the right sort of player with the right skill set.
But just a few years too late.
Oh, it must be, you know, horrendous. And Jayasuriya, I think, was on the verge of that, you know, at 38. But oddly, I think he sort of benefited in that he had this incredibly impressive career behind him. I think in particular, several sensational one-day performances against India meant that I think his reputation there was assured. And crucially, he'd retired from international cricket, so there was no issue with his availability. He would be there for Mumbai for the whole tournament. He really rolled back the years and enjoyed a wonderful few weeks, finishing as the third highest run scorer. And it was interesting because he formed what felt like a dream opening partnership with Sachin Tendulkar, but actually in reality Tendulkar was suffered a groin injury and was out for much of the tournament, and when he did play didn't do so with much success. And for all the pressure on Mumbai, who I think were in many ways seen as one of the kind of the franchise, the big, most high-profile franchise, Jayasuriya really carried that and provided that sort of entertainment.
It's a curious phenomenon, the idea of having an auction every year going forward. So, for instance, you're Jayasuriya, you're coming into 2008, you know you're nearing the end of your career. I wonder whether it's a case of kind of make hay while the sun shines, and actually you know you've got your fee for that tournament, whatever it is, nearly, you know, $1 million or pounds or whatever it was, and you're not actually worried, as you are with selection for a countryside, of playing well in order to be selected in the future. It's kind of very much a tournament by tournament thing, which I suppose is another completely different dynamic about the IPL. Sure, your performance in one tournament will dictate how valuable you are for the next, but if you're 38, you're kind of, it's a bit of a nice opportunity just to go, right, I've got my fee, I know I'm going to be here and playing now, and the pressure's in a way slightly off in that regard.
Yes, and I think there's also this issue that reputationally he didn't have anything to do. You know, he was established. He wasn't having to earn his place for future tournaments for Sri Lanka. And I think one thing that's very interesting and why Jayasuriya and Simons make very interesting as a contrast is if Deccan seem to have done their homework and really thought about what Simons could bring them as an all-rounder, Jayasuriya feels a bit more like a purchase of the heart. It feels like a kind of big name. We remember the history. We remember his sensational innings. But actually, you know, it was a gamble that succeeded hugely. I think one of the other interesting things is if you were to look at some of the teams that did well, there is something in the experience. So Mumbai actually didn't do particularly well and struggled. But for someone like the Rajasthan Royals, who went on to win the tournament, they seemed hugely reliant on the experience of Shane Warne, their captain, and they looked to that some knowledge. So I think it's that also interesting idea of what you're looking for in an overseas player. Part of that might be the know-how as much as the skills.
What all of this reminds me of is those early kind of football manager games where you have a budget and you get to choose a team, and some of it's done because in your heart of hearts when you were a kid you watched certain person play and you want them in your team, and then you think, who's the big, you know, who am I going to splash the cash on, and then who's the cheap player who I reckon will do okay because I haven't got any money left at the end. And that's kind of what it must have been like for these team owners in those early days, in terms of, you know, kids with cash being able to play out their cricket fantasies.
And I think it's exactly this. I think it's one of the fun things about looking back on the 2008 auction, because everyone is learning. You know, the owners are learning, the coaches are sort of learning, and we get some sort of mad, interesting purchases. And I think the game now is that it's moved a long way beyond that in terms of how these auctions are processed. I think we saw a little bit of that actually, and who knows, this may be a feature for a future from the archives, with the draft for the 100. You know, that seems to hugely have been informed by these years of IPL auction and everything that's been learnt from them. But it's fun, I think, to look back at these trailblazers, these people who took part in the IPL at a time when it was new, mad, and for many quite unpopular. Looking back on it now, that it's a very established and successful part of the world cricket scene. To the review, and for this episode we've been reading Pushing the Boundaries by Derek Pringle, published in 2018. Pringle was a bowling all-rounder who played for Essex in England, including during the heyday of the Essex side during the 1980s. He started his career as Ian Botham's understudy and was commonly referred to as the next Botham. He played 30 tests and 41 ODIs, and after retirement went on to build a successful career in the media. Toby, what sort of biography is this?
So the titles, it's an autobiography with three titles on the cover, and I think they kind of speak volumes about what it is. So it's Pushing the Boundaries, Cricket in the 80s, Playing Home and Away. And what those that implies, which is very true, is that it's an autobiography, but it's also a snapshot of English cricketing culture in the 1980s. So you're really taken back to this world in county cricket and in test cricket and in one day cricket in the 1980s, which feels very, very different from today. And it's an exploration of that world. The other part of this book, which is really significant, is the kind of innuendo that's suggested in Playing Home and Away is very much borne out by the many, many anecdotes in this book about dressing room culture, and particularly about the heavy drinking and womanizing that went with being a successful cricketer. It's interesting, it quotes on the back cover of the book, presumably a review from Michael Atherton, in which Atherton says, it's an engaging romp in which cricket only plays a walk-on part, which is quite interesting for the autobiography of a cricketer. What is it for you that sort of sticks in the mind as being the central themes of the book?
As you say, I mean, it is crammed with anecdotes, and I know we'll get to a few, and I think there is a real pleasure, and he tells a story very well, and I think, you know, once you've read a lot of cricket books, some stories you think, oh God, I've heard this three times told by three different players. I have to say with Pringle, I was like, these are tons of new stories. I think the slight challenge is whether when it's you get a great portrait of the off-the-field activity. I think for some readers it may start to tire after a while. I think there are some, I think it depends totally on your outlook and your interest in the game, but I think for some it might be one drinking session too many. But I do think it tells you an awful lot about Pringle and his approach to the game. I mean, you think of some of the books we've read, the sort of Bairstow biography, where it's very introspective, it's very focused on getting the best out of yourself, self-improvement. This is really breezy. You know, Pringle had fun, he had some success, he doesn't seem to harbour any regrets. I mean, am I oversimplifying? Or?
Well, no, and even compared, so Graham Fowler appears in this book a little bit, and we reviewed his autobiography recently, and again, you compare the two, and whereas Fowler is very introspective in his book, and we learn a lot about him and his inner thoughts, we don't do that in the same way with Pringle, and that's what makes it, in many ways, as, you know, the word Atherton uses, which is a romp, I think is kind of quite right. You sit down and you can breeze through this, and it's very, very stylishly written. One of the kind of huge figures in this book is Ian Botham, and you mentioned that Pringle kind of started off his professional cricket career as sort of Botham's understudy, being talked about as the next Botham, and Botham is a huge figure in this book, and in some senses this book is a kind of a bit of a sort of love letter to Botham, I suppose. And I think we do, one of the things that I learned from this book was the extent to which Botham kind of culturally dominated English cricket during that time. You know, the fact that really the English team in terms of its culture was built around Botham, and that however hard people tried to rein him in, ultimately it was that sort of strength of will that really won out, not least the fact that, and you've referred to this, these amazing stories about Botham, you know, in the after the second night of a test, say, going out and drinking, you know, a dozen pints, each one with a whiskey chaser, driving home and then being out on the cricket pitch at 10 o'clock the next morning. The kind of stuff that I read and think, I've had nights like this, like that, and it's taken me 4 days to recover. So I think that it is quite an interesting, you know, kind of exploration of what it was actually like being in a dressing room with Botham at that time.
I think it's interesting, again, making the comparison with the Fowler, because Graham Fowler's book also dedicates a substantial chapter to Botham. I mean, it clearly did make this impression on everyone he played with. I think it can lead into nostalgia, though, because we get a reflection from Pringle later in the book where he basically says, oh, we just don't have the same mavericks anymore. And I think this is all does feel a little bit rose-tinted. I mean, you look at, there's no question that the modern setup is far more professional, far less chaotic. But you think we've had an era of Kevin Peterson, of Ben Stokes, now of Jofra Archer. I mean, to tell me that these people aren't characters doing their things in their own way.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that Pringle, kind of, who is now a cricket journalist, has that kind of ability to reflect on, whether we agree with it or not, is that, you know, he played very much in the era of you know, in the amateur era, when there weren't strict team structures where players were much more left to get up to their own, you know, devices, versus now where everything is much, much more structured. And for him, that's kind of lost some of the, you know, some of the potential in the game. What is interesting is his analysis of the Essex side that he played at, played for, who won those six county championships between 78 and 93, which were the years that, that Pringle was playing for them, that legendary Essex side. And quite interesting as well to read Pringle's analysis of why that team was so successful. It was a team that didn't have a coach, or mostly didn't have a coach. Their captain, Keith Fletcher, was a massive, massive figure. And the things that that Pringle identifies in terms of what Fletcher brought to that side was, I suppose, in a way, and it comes back to this maverick thing, but he was a captain who was willing to take risks in order to win, in a time when actually quite a lot of captains were quite risk averse and would, you know, eliminate the loss before they would go for the win. Suddenly having a captain who subverted that was a really influential thing. There are also some interesting anecdotes about the fact that here was a man who had a complete inability to remember the names of players, even, you know, friends and players he'd worked with for a long while, but yet would remember, you know, having seen someone bat months before in the nets for a few balls. As soon as they walked on the pitch, he would remember what it was about them that made them vulnerable to particular types of bowling. So this kind of really particular kind of brain. And then the other aspect I think is quite interesting is having a kind of likable captain and a central figure who could, in an era when everyone did, you know, drink heavily, there wasn't much discipline, team culture could turn toxic pretty quickly, a kind of character who could draw all of that together. And so I hadn't really, you know, come across Keith Fletcher as a captain all that much, and was really interested to read about what it was that made him and his team so, so successful during that time.
I think it was very persuasive in the idea that it was a successful team culture that started from the top. Because I think sometimes you read these things and you're like, really? You know, was it that person who had that much influence? I think Pringle's perception of portrayal of Essex really makes that clear. I think we have to cover some of the anecdotes, because I think this is, as we said, it is a triumph of anecdotes. A quick one of my favourites was certainly... one from Australia. So, you know, the challenges I think are well known of fielding in Australia. If we ever felt it was tough for modern cricketers, Ian Gold, Gunnar Gould, fielding near the boundary, finds himself having a meat pie dumped on his head by a spectator. And I think the idea of having to sort of return to your position with
in
this
baking
kind of,
heat.
Oh, God. With this
gravy,
sort of gravy
oozing,
oozing. Oh, and the extraordinary thing is he manages a kind of retort to the crowd that actually gets them on his side. So I think quite one thing to deal with the shock of that, and another to keep your good humour. Yep. Which are the anecdotes? It's a tough choice on this, but which are the ones that stick out for you?
It is. There are a lot of them. I mean, one thing that I was fascinated by was the story around very early in his career when he was still at Cambridge University, and he'd been picked to play in the varsity match, the annual Cambridge versus Oxford match, but it clashed with a test against India at Lord's, playing for England. And he chose to play for England and got absolutely lambasted by the press for abandoning his university and for having, you know, no sense of allegiance, which is just absolutely unthinkable nowadays. Clearly, if you did it the other way around, I think you'd be lambasted in this day and age. So I think that just indicated quite how different sort of cricketing culture and cricketing establishment was at that time, that that he got pilloried in the press for that.
So I think, in conclusion, any cricket fan, I think, is likely to wallow and enjoy the many tales on offer here. I don't think you're going to walk away with sort of in-depth reflections on sort of the nature of the game. But that's not what every cricket book is supposed to be about.
And that was Pushing the Boundaries by Derek Pringle, published just last year in 2018. And that is the 118th episode of Reverse Prep Radio. Please, if you've enjoyed this, hop over onto iTunes, leave us a review. We've always said this, but it is sort of the number one way of how other people get to hear about us if we're well reviewed on iTunes. Thank you for joining us. This might be the last episode of 2019 and what a year it's been. But we will be back with more cricketing conundrums and anecdotes before long.